From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, NPR's Nina Totenberg on the brouhaha over whether Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg should retire.
But first, the future of the internet in the U.S. is up for debate in a committee room in Washington today. The Federal Communications Commission is reviewing a proposal that would allow big companies like Comcast and Google to pay more for faster internet service to their customers. It involves the complex concept called net neutrality, and critics say the FCC's proposal could mean the end of the internet as we know it. Siva Vaidyanathan is professor of media studies at the University of Virginia. He's with us from Charlottesville. Siva, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Well, do you think this would end the internet as we know it?
Well, it's been a slow, steady decline for a number of years now. Basically, we're going to look back on this event as a major point in the end of our sort of 20-year wild ride with an open, creative, competitive internet. And the United States, by giving up on network neutrality, which is what we're really talking about here, is going in the opposite direction of other major countries that have decided that an open and free internet is a really good thing. Just yesterday, the government of Brazil approved a bill that would establish and preserve network neutrality in Brazil, and the European Union did the same thing a couple of weeks ago. So what's happening here is we're basically capitulating to the wishes of Comcast and other major internet service providers and the short-term immediate needs of the big players in the web video world like Amazon and Netflix and Google, et cetera.
But how are we capitulating if they're going to have to pay more, or they would have to pay more under these proposals to get faster speeds?
Well, currently and traditionally, internet information, data, packets would flow at an equal rate, regardless of who sent them. So if I started a web video platform, Siva's web video service, and I wanted to post web videos on a server that I controlled, I would have an equal shot at having my video appear clearly on your computer. I would have no advantage or disadvantage over a YouTube video or a video sent through Amazon Prime. Under this new system, They're going to create a fast lane through which the wealthier, better established companies can pay a premium, one might call it an extortion fee, so that those services arrive cleaner, fuller, in higher definition, and more dependably than the coach class or the slow lane that the rest of us are going to have to wallow in. And that means that it's going to severely limit competition from future companies, future innovators, the next Skype, the next YouTube, the next Facebook, because they're not going to be able to compete in high quality unless they pay an extortion fee.
You're saying it harms innovation. Of course, the FCC denies that. The commissioner, Tom Wheeler, says there are reports that the FCC is gutting the open internet rule. They are flat out wrong. There is no turnaround in policy. The same rules will apply to all internet content.
He's being disingenuous at best. This does change the game. This does double down on the advantages that the wealthy, established, and politically powerful companies like Amazon, Google, Facebook, Microsoft have, along with what is becoming a behemoth in our society, one of the most politically powerful and influential companies in the history of this nation, Comcast. Comcast is now playing a role not unlike Standard Oil in the 1890s or AT&T in the 1970s or Microsoft in the 1990s. And we have to ask ourselves, is that the sort of model we want in this new century? And I think this result, this rule proposal by the FCC, is a direct reflection of the naked political power that Comcast has.
But if you don't offer the idea of a fast lane that companies can pay more for, who pays for the ability of all of us to have an equal chance of getting fast speed video, for example, coming through on the internet? There's not an unlimited amount of bandwidth out there.
Sure, but what's happened is the major internet service provider companies, the major cable companies in this country, soon to become one, As Comcast tries to buy Time Warner Cable. Those companies have been holding back on upgrades for a number of years. The United States has some of the slowest broadband in the developed world, and that's intentional. That's because they have been able to say, your broadband is slow and clogged up by Netflix because of network neutrality. The fact is, we could have both. We could have fast broadband and network neutrality. And we're seeing that experimentally, for instance, with Google Fiber in Kansas City and soon in Austin, Texas. We're seeing the capability of building out high-speed, high-quality, neutral networks. We could have network service that strong, that broadly, in other major cities and, in fact, across the nation. But we lack the political will, largely because there's this very powerful company that gets to call the shots.
Siva Vaidyanathan, what do you think this means for consumers and what they will pay for internet service?
We'll pay a little bit more for the subscriptions to Amazon Prime and Netflix, because those companies are going to have to pay this extortion toll to keep flowing in the fast lane, and they're going to have to pass that cost on to us. I think that's fairly trivial. In fact, what we get for it is probably going to be higher quality. Orange is the new black. The orange will be brighter. The black will be deeper. You know, but, and so, you know, if that's a trade-off for this amount of political power and ability to shape public policy, well, that's what we choose. But what we're losing is not something we can ever count. An environment, a set of assumptions about a level playing field for innovation and expression. I'm probably going to sit down this weekend and draft a book proposal for a history, the rise and fall of the internet as we know it. Because, you know, what we're really seeing is a big shift in how data flows and who gets to control it, monitor it, and monetize it.
Siva Vaidyanathan, professor of media studies at the University of Virginia, talking about these new proposals from the FCC regarding net neutrality. Siva Vaidyanathan, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Well, the Supreme Court is hearing arguments in some cases and deciding others this week, but outside the court, questions about retirement. Last month, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg celebrated her 81st birthday, and that added to calls from liberals that she step down under a Democratic president who would presumably replace her with a like-minded justice. But justices are supposed to be beyond politics. Well, last Sunday on ABC's This Week, retired Justice John Paul Stevens seemed to disagree. He said it was only natural for justices to take politics into account when considering retirement.
You're interested in the job and in the kind of work that's done. You have to have an interest in who's going to fill your shoes.
NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg has, of course, been inside the court, but we asked her to step out to weigh in. Nina, how much of a buzz has this retirement talk been at the court?
Well, I really have to tell you that for those of us who cover the court, we don't pay much attention to it because Ginsburg's made pretty clear that she has not much intention of retiring this term, at least as long as she's well. In fact, she's made it pretty clear that she really, I don't know at what point in the future she might decide to retire, but that it's not right now.
Yeah. What is the tightrope that justices walk when they consider retirement?
I think the tightrope for most justices is to make sure that they're not gaga and that they all worry that by the time they should go, they won't know that they should go. So it's easy for Justice Stevens to make that inference about Justice Ginsburg. But of course, he was 90 when he retired and she's 81. And what did it for him was his announcement of the dissent in the Citizens United campaign elections case, campaign funding case. And he had a very long dissent from the bench. And he was tripping over his words and having difficulty enunciating his dissent. And he actually went to the doctor afterwards to check himself out. Everything was fine. But that was the final push for him, he told me. That was what finally made him say, okay, the time has come.
But what about this idea that justices consider who their replacement might be? Ruth Marcus writes about this in the Washington Post, and she says, of course, justices can't be insensitive to the identity of their successors because they care about their work and they want to care about who will pick it up or, as she writes, dismantle it. The late Chief Justice William Rehnquist has said in the past that it's not 100% true that they calculate, but sometimes they do. What about that calculation, thinking about who the president will be when they retire?
Well, I think that they must think about it, but they also think about themselves and their contributions and whether they want to stay and think they have something yet to contribute, perhaps even more to contribute.
When I asked you about the tightrope, do justices think about giving the wrong impression, giving the impression that they are retiring so that a like-minded successor can be appointed?
I think they have pretty thick skins about this. I mean, they do take some measures. Last summer, for example, Ginsburg, with obvious malice of forethought, gave a bunch of interviews in which she said, look, I'm not going anywhere right now, in order to head off that kind of speculation. You can't do it every year. And you can't do it when one of your former colleagues starts talking about maybe you should retire because you're 81, even though he was 90 when he retired.
Well, but Ruth Marcus also writes, and some have said, that those who are calling, outright calling for Justice Ginsburg to step down, they include Irvine School of Law Dean Erwin Chemerinsky, who said, you know, quit while there's a Democratic president who will be able to choose a successor who shares your views and values. The more there is a call for her to step down, or any justice to step down, the less likely they will, because then it will appear as if they're doing it for that purpose.
Look, justices and law professors and law school deans are not known for their political acumen. Therefore, perhaps Dean Chemerinsky is unaware of the fact that it's entirely possible that if Justice Ginsburg were to step down at the end of this term, nobody would be confirmed until after the election. And if then there was a Republican Senate, Republican-controlled Senate, it's not entirely clear that any Obama nominee would be confirmed. Conversely, perhaps Justice Ginsburg thinks that there will be a President Hillary Clinton in 2017 taking office who can name a replacement. And that may well not happen. These people are not political experts. They just aren't.
Nina Totenberg, NPR's legal affairs correspondent, who will now go back to doing the thing that she does, which is covering the cases that the court is taking up this week. Nina, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Apple and Facebook's stock both popped up at the open on Wall Street this morning after they both announced record first quarter profits. Apple announced a 7% increase in profit, while Facebook reported a tripling of its profit from the same period a year ago. That's thanks largely to money it is making on mobile advertising. Joining us to talk about all of this from New York is Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, welcome back.
Good to be here.
And there are some people who are saying, wake up, everyone. This is a bubble. It is going to burst. There is a bubble going on in the tech sector, just like there was years ago. And we're going to get to that. But first of all, I just want to hear about what is going on at both of these big companies. Let's first talk about Apple. Here is CEO Tim Cook making the announcement yesterday on a conference call.
We have a lot to share with you over the next hour, and I'd like to start right away with the very strong results we're reporting for the March quarter. We generated $45.6 billion in revenue, which was ahead of our expectations and represents a new March quarter record and is our strongest non-holiday quarter ever.
Derek Thompson, what is going on with Apple?
$46 billion in 3 months. Apple is rich. It is so rich. It is the richest public company in the world. But this quarter, what we need to talk about are phones. Apple sold 44 million iPhones, way more than anybody expected. And the phone story here is really a foreign story. More people overseas are buying iPhones. Apple struck a deal to sell iPhones in China, in Japan. They're selling like hotcakes. In Latin America, iPhone sales are on fire. Customers in these countries aren't necessarily buying the most expensive phones available, the iPhone 5, but they're buying older phones with good value like the iPhone 4S. Meanwhile, Apple's iPad sales have basically flatlined. Apple has been a phone company for a long time, but that is more true now than ever.
But what about innovation? This has been the big criticism that since Steve Jobs died, Apple has not come out with a new product every year or so, something that changes the way we go about our lives.
The curse of expectations. Yeah, I mean, Apple did reinvent the consumer electronic market every 2 to 5 years, it seemed like, for a while in the 2000s. That's an impossible streak to keep up. People think they might release a bigger iPhone later this year. They might release an iWatch, a smarter watch. It is true that Apple right now seems a little bit more like Microsoft from the 1990s. They're better at tweaking extremely successful products than they are at building out new successful products. But eyes on the big picture here. We're still talking about the richest public company in America.
But in the announcement yesterday, there were some notes that were taken very well by shareholders, things that make the stock a little more attractive to own, which signals perhaps that Apple is looking more to Wall Street than it is to its customers, no?
Apple announced it's raising its dividend to reward investors. It also announced it's buying back stock to encourage investors, and it's splitting its stock price to seduce investors, to make people able to buy stock at a lower price. Let me try out an analogy here. I think the best way to understand Apple is that it's a little bit like America. It's like Western Europe and other advanced economies. We're too rich to grow quickly. But what happens when a country gets old and rich? It loses percentage points of growth, and it starts spending its wealth on benefits, you know, health, social security. Hmm. Apple has lost percentage points of growth. This has been a huge story the last few years, that Apple isn't growing the way we're used to. And until it reinvents the smartwatch or something, it will continue to grow quite slowly. But it's spending its wealth on benefits for investors, on dividends, on buybacks that say we believe in this company, on stock splits to get younger, perhaps lower income investors to buy into it. Hmm. They're more focused, as you said, on the stock right now because I think they want to keep investors in the game until they come out with the next blockbuster product.
Okay, let's talk about Facebook, the other company that just came out with its earnings. As we said, a tripling of profit from a year ago. Mark Zuckerberg shared the company's good news on a conference call. Let's listen.
When you look at our business performance, we've also made some good progress. Our total revenue grew 72% year over year. Our advertising grew 82%, our strongest annual growth rate in nearly 3 years. And mobile accounted for 59% of our advertising revenue. These results show Facebook's business is strong and growing, and we're in a great position to continue making progress towards our mission.
Derek, you have done a lot of reporting on mobile advertising and how that is shaping up as a big part of Silicon Valley's growth going forward. Tell us what Facebook did here. How they did it.
Remember when I said Apple was a phone company?
Yeah.
Facebook is a phone company, too. 60% of its ad revenue came from mobile, and mobile basically means phones all around the world. Facebook is performing something of a magic trick here, actually. You know, while Google, which is the other huge player in mobile advertising, has seen its ads get cheaper and cheaper on phones, Facebook today announced something really astonishing. Its ads are getting more valuable. It reported its average effective price per ad doubled since a year ago, even though total ad impressions declined by 17%. In short, that means it's showing fewer ads, but the ads are worth more. That's great for Facebook, and frankly, it's great for people like you and me if we don't like ads. It's a remarkable trend for everybody.
How is it good for people who don't like ads?
Total ad impressions are declining. Now, eventually, you might see a situation where Facebook needs to make more and more money, and there's two ways to do this from advertising. You can have higher prices on the ads, or you can have more ad units. So I don't want to predict here that we'll never see more ads in our Facebook stream. I think eventually Facebook, as an advertising company, is going to have to show more ads. But right now, the trend is really beautiful for the company. Mobile ads for them are getting more valuable. It's remarkable.
And Facebook has been making these big investments. It bought the company WhatsApp. It bought the virtual reality company Oculus. Is it all about acquisition now for Facebook's future?
It's interesting. I think that what Facebook sees right now is that its core business, Facebook, is sort of maturing. And it needs to make bets on a future in Facebook that might be post-Facebook. And so it's saying, okay, what are young people using, and what can we imagine to be the technologies of the future? Well, young people right now are using WhatsApp. It's this remarkably popular international texting service.
Right.
And then with Oculus, you have a virtual gaming company that could potentially revolutionize the way that we want to consume media in a virtual world that we basically put in front of our eyes. It's a bet on a future that might not materialize for 10, 20 years, but I think that Mark Zuckerberg's bet, I think his bet, is that Facebook is going to be healthy enough for the next few years. So it needs to get in at these companies when their valuations are lower and buy a potential future that we won't see for another 10 or 15 years. I think it's a savvy move.
Derek, we just have a minute left, but are we in a tech bubble? This is what everybody's wondering.
So when investors say they're worried about a tech bubble, it means they're worried that investors are overvaluing companies and that those valuations will correct majorly and all of this money will leave tech. Facebook, though, is a maturing company that is making money. And Apple is a very mature company that is making lots of money. So the bubble in tech is not so much about Apple and Facebook. It's more about things like we talked about last week, Airbnb, companies that are valued around $10 billion but aren't showing consistent profits. Mm. It's impossible to know exactly what these companies should be worth or when this bubble, if it is a bubble, will pop. But it does seem clear that there are enormous, enormous valuations and multiples for companies based not on their profits, yeah, but on their reach, on their popularity, and the number of users that they have around the world.
Derek, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And if you don't have health insurance coverage, getting a price up front to figure out your medical treatment can be nearly impossible. But one New Hampshire hospital is trying to change that model. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, NHPR's Todd Bookman has the story.
You don't drop everything to go get a colonoscopy. But after a decade of waiting, 63-year-old Richard Call of Manchester knew he couldn't keep putting it off.
It's something you got to do, you're supposed to do. There was a little bit of history in my family, so I was encouraged to do it.
But Call doesn't have insurance, and the price tag, actually the lack of a price tag, kept getting in the way.
Shopping around, and everybody I asked, whether it was a doctor or an institution like a hospital, they just looked at me like I was crazy.
Call is his own boss, a property manager. He prices out building materials, paint, lumber, all before purchasing. He couldn't understand why a colonoscopy didn't work the same way. Then earlier this year, he saw an advertisement in the Sunday paper. $2,000 paid up front at Elliott Hospital.
It was real easy. Just went in there, they put me to sleep and woke me up and said goodbye.
Call should be happy. He got a clean bill of health and a good price. The Elliott is now offering colonoscopies along with hernia repair or knee arthroscopy for one all-inclusive fee. It calls them care bundles.
Understandably, everyone in America is frustrated by the lack of transparency in health care.
Dr. Rick Phelps is president of Elliott Hospital. He says the initiative is a way to inform patients.
I think that frustration has been exacerbated with all of the high deductible health plans that are out there. So now we've created consumerism. The problem is we haven't armed the consumer with access to the information that they need to make smart decisions.
Transparency isn't widespread in healthcare, but it isn't exactly new to New Hampshire. In 2007, the state insurance department launched nhhealthcost.org, a little marketed website that lists the prices of about 40 common procedures at hospitals around the state. In its infancy, the project offered something of a laboratory for how transparency could impact the cost of care.
It does lead to a lot of follow-up questions, and one of them is whether or not the market would respond.
Tyler Brannon with the state's insurance department says researchers tracked nhhealthcost.org to see if prices changed after becoming public. That is, would some of the market variability be smoothed out by more transparency? Would hospitals that charge more for that colonoscopy be forced to lower their prices? The results, in the end, suggested otherwise.
We did not see essentially the market responding.
Brannon says what is changing has more to do with how insurance companies design plans. Many now offer incentives, including reduced copays, if you use a preferred medical provider, one with lower prices but good quality. And some large employers are following a similar track. Walmart, Lowe's, and PepsiCo have struck deals with hospitals around the country, including the Mayo Clinic, where an employee's surgery can be performed with a fixed, known cost to the company. Elliott Hospital hopes to launch similar relationships through its care bundles. But for now, only the uninsured can get the set price procedures, says Dr. Phelps.
In our disclaimer on our ad, the first word is regrettably, and I want to emphasize that. We truly regret at this moment that we don't have the capacity to offer these care bundles to all employers, to all patients, to all insurers.
The barriers include the complicated web of contracts that bind hospitals, doctors, and insurers, a system not easy to change. Phelps also says there are IT challenges to making the bundles work, but with ever-rising deductibles, even insured patients are pressuring the industry to put a clearer price on their care. For Here and Now, I'm Todd Bookman.
And it's not uncommon for those Sunday political talk shows to make news that sets the agenda for the week. But this week started with news about the talk shows themselves. Specifically, NBC's Meet the Press with David Gregory, which has dropped to third place in the ratings behind ABC's This Week and CBS's Face the Nation. The show has been struggling ever since David Gregory took over for the late Tim Russert, who died back in 2008. NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik is here to talk more about Meet the Press and the other Sunday shows. David, welcome.
Hey, Jeremy. Good to join.
Well, let's start with Meet the Press. And as we said, David Gregory replaced Meet the Press, who was known as a tough cross-examiner on the show. I want to listen to a little bit of classic Tim Russert. This is from 1991. He is grilling the former KKK member and Congressman David Duke, who was running at the time for governor of Louisiana.
Mr. Duke, please. In terms of economic development, the condition of your state, how many people in your state live below the poverty line?
A great percentage. So we have the highest per capita percentage in the country, just about the last five states of the country.
How many?
I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, sir.
Sir,
I don't carry around an almanac with me.
Well, if I told
guarantee you,
if I told you it was 25% of your state live below the poverty line, would you believe me?
I could believe you, yes.
Are these the kinds of things a governor should know? Who the largest employers are? How many people live below the poverty line?
David Folkenflik, is it possible that anybody who replaced Tim Russert would have lost in the ratings? That style of interviewing just it doesn't exist out there in the landscape today on television.
Yeah, no, I think pretty much anyone was guaranteed to lose that, in part because of the dynamic nature of Tim Russert. I mean, think of what we just heard there. There was a guy in an unusual moment, David Duke, an unusual candidate, to be sure, but a moment at which Tim Russert was essentially serving as an arbiter and saying, I'm going to referee the validity of this guy as a person fit for public office in a way where the parties were not quite capable of doing. You know, David Gregory arrives at a time where, you know, the three shows combined on the major networks, the major old broadcast networks, if I'm not mistaken, themselves have about what Russert earned on his own in terms of an audience. So it wasn't going to be the same. We live in a more fractured age, and that takes place both on TV and in other platforms as well. But Gregory just doesn't have that same commanding presence. He doesn't quite have that same zest for the game. And there's a question and a conversation going on not only around him in the media space, but at his own network and his own employer, whether he can be relevant, provocative, timely, and meaningful enough to really carry the mantle of what is TV's oldest continuously running show.
Well, let's listen to him. Here's David Gregory interviewing Glenn Greenwald last year, the journalist who broke the Edward Snowden story on NSA spying. Let's listen.
To the extent that you have aided and abetted Snowden, even in his current movements, why shouldn't you, Mr. Greenwald, be charged with a crime?
I think it's pretty extraordinary that anybody who would call themselves a journalist would publicly muse about whether or not other journalists should be charged with felonies. The assumption in your question, David, is completely without evidence, the idea that I've aided and abetted him in any way.
David, that is probably the exception rather than the rule in terms of the style of interviewing that David Gregory does. Is that your sense?
Yeah, no, I think you've got it exactly right. And I think I'm really glad that you played that clip. I mean, that was a moment in which Gregory, at minimum, wanted to be heard asking something that sounded like a very tough question. He was asking of Glenn Greenwald, then of The Guardian, who helped lead, you know, that British and now American news organization to share in a Pulitzer for its exposure of stuff the NSA was doing, thanks to the disclosures from Mr. Snowden. And, you know, he used aid and abetting, which has a legal meaning to it. Certainly there have been some conservatives, some national security hawks, that have accused The Guardian and The Washington Post of doing that in a sense of helping Snowden. But saying that really is notion of that somehow journalists are acting in an espionage role, and that seems far and wide of the mark. And in reality, although it sounds like a tough question, what it's really doing is serving as a protective shield for uncomfortable questions that people in the national security sphere, in the Obama administration and in the Bush administration before it, questions that they would rather not have to answer for. So, you know, it's one of these moments where in seemingly carrying out a journalistic enterprise and all people are open to all kinds of questions, but in seeming to do that, you know, what Gregory is actually doing is protecting the forces of the establishment in government at that moment when they should be the ones in some ways most held to account.
But one of the things that I have noticed about David Gregory's show, and I watch it occasionally, is that he has tried to get out of the inside the beltway conversation, at least to some extent, and talk about other issues as well. He, of course, is from Los Angeles. But I remember Christian Amanpour coming into ABC's This Week when George Stephanopoulos left to go to Good Morning America before he came back to the show. She tried to do a more international show and it didn't work. Do people just want these inside the beltway Republican Democrat back and forth conversations on Sunday?
Well, I think part of the problem is that that formula that you're describing is very tired. I don't really want to see the head of the DNC and the head of the RNC, the two party chiefs, as it were, you know, offering their kind of ritualized binary partisan talking points. It just doesn't do anything for me. And I'm somebody who is very interested in politics. I can't imagine that the public at large, which can get things from Fire Dog Lakes and Real Clear Politics and the Weekly Standard and any number of other sources, really thinks that's going to be that fresh and new. You know, by the same token, I do think opening it up for other topics, domestic, foreign, you know, the idea of confusing federal news as the only definition of national or domestic news is a mistake, right? It should be incorporated. But, and David's tried some other things. He does this thing, Tweet the Press, where he sort of poses questions online. But, you know, the freshest thing that I saw in this regard was when Jake Tapper was a substitute hosting for a stretch on This Week for ABC News, and he incorporated PolitiFacts fact checkers where they'd come after the fact and fact checked a assertions made by various guests on the show. I thought that was real breath of fresh air. Of course, Jake is now an anchor and host on CNN. He left ABC more than a year ago, and to me, that was the biggest innovation, and that was some time ago. I think that you're going to have a combination of the question of approach, of really shaking up the kinds of guests that you invite in and not simply trying to shake it up so that you have more incendiary statements on the air, but perhaps different kinds of insights and different kinds of dissections, not necessarily these binary arguments that I think often don't yield that much.
Well, and a lot of people have been tweeting about this today, about the idea that these shows, which used to have maybe one long interview or two long interviews in the whole hour, now have turned into 5 minutes of this, then 10 minutes with the panel, then 5 minutes of this, then 10 minutes with the panel. They've broken up, gotten a lot different just in their format. David Folkenflik, NPR media correspondent, thanks so much as always.
You bet.
Trends pass, animals become extinct, sounds also die. For instance, do you know what this is? That, my friend, is a Teagle semi-automatic stop-cylinder printing press from the late 19th or early 20th century. It was last used professionally in 1987. It's powered by a flywheel. After every imprint, the printer manually removes the paper and then feeds in the new blank sheet. Well, that was obviously not going to last. But how about this? Well, thankfully, that has also gone extinct. It's a guillotine. And these are just two of the sounds being archived at the Museum of Work in Norrköping, Sweden. The museum is housed in an old cotton mill. It aims to document working life and bring its history to life with an archive of old equipment and products. It's funny, in researching this story, we noticed there are museums of work here in the U.S., one in Woonsocket, Rhode Island, that tells of the French Canadians who came to work in the mills there. But now, in addition to collecting old artifacts in Sweden, curator Torsten Nielsen is collecting what he calls endangered sounds of the industrial era, and he joins us from the studios of the Swedish Broadcasting Corporation. Torsten, welcome.
Thank you very much.
What was your thinking behind doing this?
We were thinking that we have to do this because nobody is doing it. We live in a society which is changing very fast, so... And we have the technology now. It's quite cheap. It's sometimes we can understand what we're doing. So let's do it now.
But so again, beyond the fact that they're going to disappear, what's important about them?
The important thing is that they are a part of our history. The oldest recording we have in the world is from 1860. It's a French woman singing a song. And... That's quite recent that happened. So times are changing very fast, and we don't know how. For instance, I don't know how my hometown sounded 100 years ago.
Hmm. Yeah.
But I sure would want to know.
Well, you miss the sounds from more recently than that. You say you grew up in a small village there. Is there a sound that you miss?
Yeah, when I was a little kid, when I went to bed, I could hear the sound from the from the small factory in my hometown. They produced paper pulp, and there was a hatch, and I can hear it very, very good in the winter nights, 20 degrees below zero, and it was amazing.
And you miss that?
I miss it, yeah.
Well, let's listen to some of the other sounds that might have been music to other people's ears that you are now gathering. We're just going to let this one play and see if our listeners know what it is. Torsten, you recorded it. Do you know what it is?
Yeah, I know what it is, but I don't think you're pretty nice to your listeners because they won't have a clue.
They won't have a clue.
No.
What is it?
But I think this was something you used a lot in the countryside. It's a fence-making machine.
Fence-making? Now what? This isn't wood, is it? What kind of fence?
Not like barbed wire, but metallic fences.
And what is the machine doing? What are we hearing?
It's actually, in comes a wire and out comes a fence. It's quite amazing, and it's a very old machine. It's from the 1930s.
Well, and why might that? I can't think of another way to do that. Why might that become extinct?
Because it's a very small machine. We do fences a lot faster today.
Yeah. And computers have gotten involved in making things. But we're also reminded that computers themselves are replaced constantly. These aren't just very, very old sounds that are endangered. They are more recent sounds that are suddenly very, very old. Let's listen to something that has become ancient history to a lot of people. Guess what this is? Picture a thick old IBM desktop, the original PS1 from 1990 with a floppy disk. Torsten, as you say at your website, IBM made the decision to put the power supply in the monitor, making use of third-party monitors difficult and essentially impractical, and limiting the usefulness of this computer if the monitor needed service. Hence, no more IBM desktops from the 1990s. What does that tell you, Torsten Nielsen, that this machine that was so new just recently is now so old?
Yeah, it tells us that the times are changing very quickly. And I would say the last 20 years is like an industrial revolution to us.
All over
everything
again. Everything
is changing.
Yeah. Well, and there's another relatively recent sound that you captured. Let's listen and see if listeners know what this is. Torsten?
Yeah?
You'd say what?
I say the ones who know this sound, they know the feeling too.
It's a tattoo machine.
Yeah, it hurts.
But again, why would this become extinct?
Because we do a lot of tattoos in Sweden right now. It's very common, and I would say in a couple of years, people will start thinking, oh my God, why did we do this?
So you're thinking that that might just not be a preference anymore, and for that reason it might be endangered. Well, our tattoo fans in the audience are going to take you up on that.
Yeah, maybe. I would say that all sounds aren't endangered, but they're pretty cool anyway.
Let's listen to another sound. This might be very familiar to people who live on coasts. It's a shipyard crane. What did you want to say about a shipyard crane sound?
I would say that a couple of years ago, Sweden was very famous for building ships. We have nearly no shipbuilding at all in Sweden in these days. So here we have something also changing very fast.
As the industry goes, the sound goes with it. Hmm. What are the sounds that you want to collect in the future? I know you want to have 600 or so total. You've got only about 22 now, so you've got some work cut out for you. What sounds are you looking for?
I'm going to record a mill in a couple of days, quite old one. It's run by a water wheel, and for sure, what I know I'm going to record is chainsaws, of course, from the Swedish forest industry. And we have a lot of chainsaws in Sweden, so that's quite a common sound for us to hear. It's very noisy and aggressive, that one we will record. And also an air compressor from Atlas Copco, made 1905 for a mine. So it pumped compressed air into the mine.
Well, we know that your project is in part supported by the EU. What do people say to you about this? When you mention it there in Sweden, does everybody have a sound that they come up with? What do people say to you?
Yeah, people are very interested in sounds, and a lot of people come up with a lot of ideas about what we should record. I have one person very close to me. She says she loves the sound of a washing machine. not the noisy part, the trembling, but actually the washing part. And also the sound, the tone of the city is changing very much. Today, it's harder to find silence than to find sounds. We would say that silence is the most endangered thing.
Yeah, the most endangered sound. Fascinating. That's Torsten Nielsen, curator at the Museum of Work in Norrköping, Sweden, collecting and archiving what he calls endangered sounds of the industrial era. Torsten, thanks so much for sharing them with us.
Thank you very much.